And it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis wants to remind you that perhaps a pencil and paper would be handy to write down some information that you might want to refer to later. Because you never know. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the environment, and there's our ways for you to help and get involved. So do have your pencil and paper handy. And the first is that if you're in the San Jose area and you want to listen to Greg King, he's going to be speaking on Friday, March 7th from noon to 1:15 p.m. at the Picardo Business Complex, room 004. And who's Greg King, you ask? Well, he's a writer and a photographer, and he's also the executive director of the Siskiyou Land Conservancy. But what he mostly is the guy who found Headwaters Forest. And Greg King will provide an image and information-rich talk tracing the history of the Redwood ecosystem and its collision with Western humanity, including his ancestors, who during the 1800s owned one of the largest redwood mills in Sonoma County. The lecture focuses on efforts to protect Headwaters Forest, which King discovered and named in 1987, and its place in the history of redwood logging and redwood protection. So once again, Greg King speaking at San Jose State University, Friday, March 7th from noon to 1:15 p.m. at the Picardo Business Complex, room 004. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Yellowstone National Park has been capturing and consigning wild buffalo to slaughter since February 7th, yet for the first time since their involvement, they have not sent out a single press release. Daily phone calls to Yellowstone officials have gone unanswered, while the park's public information officer says he has not been receiving timely or complete information. We have been told by Yellowstone spokesperson that Superintendent Dan Wenk doesn't want press releases going out. The Buffalo Field Campaign has been diligent in trying to gain as much information as possible from firsthand observations by field patrols and numerous calls to Yellowstone and the tribes. Through Buffalo Field Campaign's observations and investigations, we know that at least 275 of America's last wild buffalo have been captured for slaughter. To date, 37 wild buffalo have been sent to slaughter by the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, 84 have been sent to slaughter by the Intertribal Buffalo Council, and 35 had been sent to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service for use in research. With at least 120 buffalo still in the trap, more are bound for tribal slaughter or government research in the coming days. To date, 172 wild buffalo have been killed by Native Americans hunting under treaties, and 35 have been killed by hunters holding Montana tags. The Montana hunt is now over, but tribes will continue hunting through March, ending when buffalo calving season is barely a month away. This week, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have not encountered a single mature bull, an indication that all in the Gardner Basin have been killed by hunters. Family groups of pregnant females and calves are being shattered. Treaty hunters have been chasing buffalo out of areas that would be difficult for them to retrieve carcasses from and pushing them into places right along Forest Service roads where it's easy. State law prohibits group hunting, which is the chasing of animals toward awaiting rifles. This is not hunting. This is massacre. On Wednesday morning, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols saw livestock trailers coming into the Gardner Basin. As we have done, we positioned ourselves in a spot where we can view the Stevens Creek bison trap with a spotting scope. We can't get closer due to an unreasonable 7-mile closure around the trap site. We saw the trailers lined up to the chutes with men walking on the catwalks and loading up buffalo. We positioned our patrol to a choke point where we knew we'd meet the trailers so that we could document what Yellowstone is trying to withhold from the public. A convoy of three intertribal buffalo council livestock trailers hauling 39 wild buffalo to slaughter was escorted by Yellowstone National Park law enforcement and a Montana Department of Livestock stock inspector. We got into position to film them at the Corwin Springs Bridge before they got onto Highway 89 and took the buffalo to Big Timber, Montana for slaughter. Peter, a seasoned BFC coordinator and volunteer, was determined to get footage of the buffalo inside the stock trailers so we could show the public what Yellowstone is hiding. Peter positioned himself alongside the road where the trailers would have to slow down to make a turn onto the highway. Yellowstone doesn't want the public to see what they are doing to these gentle giants. Yellowstone used to be up front with this, but this year they are trying to hide their nefarious actions against America's last wild migratory buffalo. Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wink has never presided over buffalo slaughter before, and he's the first superintendent of Yellowstone to withhold timely and complete information from the public. Every other superintendent has disclosed information, but not Dan Wink. At the time of this writing, patrols are monitoring an Animal Plant Health Inspection Service trailer pulled up to the trap chute, ready to take away more wild buffalo. Wild buffalo are simply trying to migrate for their survival. It is their home, the land they have known for 800,000 years or more. Once they walked with woolly mammoths and they survived the Ice Age, but it is unclear if they can survive the human race. If you want more information about the Buffalo Field campaign, how you can donate to them, what you can donate to them, and how to volunteer, please go to their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. When you have something to send them, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. Their phone number, in case you have any questions, is 406-646-0070. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a night battle has erupted in the Southern Ocean Whale War in this story from the Environment News Service. What has become an annual battle between Japanese whaling fleets and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society over the taking of whales by the Japanese in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary erupted again last Sunday night. Sea Shepherd Australian officials and ship captains say the Japanese whaling fleet launched a six-hour night attack on the Sea Shepherd conservation ship, the Bob Barker, on Sunday night. The Tokyo-based Institute of Cetacean Research, which manages the Japanese research whaling program, counters with claims that the Japanese vessels were subject to sabotage by the Sea Shepherd ship, Bob Barker. Sea Shepherd claims the attack on the Bob Barker was unprovoked and says the assault was an attempt to deter the Bob Barker from blocking the slipway of the Nishin Maru, where it was preventing the whaler's ability to load whales poached from the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. In an attempt to disable the conservation ship's propellers, the harpoon ships Yushin Maru and Yushin Maru No. 3 crossed the bow of the Bob Barker a total of 33 times at close range during the assault, dragging 250-meter and 150-meter steel cables across the bow of the Bob Barker, Sea Shepherd Australia said in a statement. The factory whaling ship Nishin Maru was located on early Sunday morning for the third time this season by the Sea Shepherd helicopter. Whaling vessels delayed an attack on the Bob Barker until Sunday night, launching their onslaught on the conservation vessel under the cover of darkness. The Bob Barker was sailing 6 nautical miles behind the Japanese factory whaling vessel Nishin Maru at 73 degrees 8 minutes south, 175 degrees 33 minutes east when the attack began. Captain Peter Hammerstedt of the Bob Barker reports, quote, "I radioed the harpoon ships to let them know that our operations are completely lawful and that any aggressive action on their part would be reported to the Australian government and the New Zealand Search and Rescue, and that Australian Environment Minister Greg Hunt had been contacted. I have 9 Australians and 1 New Zealander on board as part of my brave crew who have endured this ruthless assault," said Hammerstedt. "We maintain unwavering dedication in the face of an increasingly vicious onslaught from the poachers, the last line of defense standing between these criminals and the protected whales they are targeting to kill," unquote. The harpoon ships crossed the bow of the Barker 15 times from port to starboard during the attack in violation of the international regulations on preventing collisions at sea, said Hammerstedt. The whaling fleet's crew threw ice at the crew of the Bob Barker's small boats, which were launched to defend the conservation ship from the onslaught, he said. The whalers also blinded those on the bridge of the Bob Barker with powerful searchlights, impairing vision and endangering navigation. The Bob Barker is currently within close range of the Yushin Maru and Yushin Maru No. 3 and can't confirm that the 2 harpoon vessels are unable to whale. Since locating the factory vessel Nishin Maru early Sunday morning, the Sea Shepherd fleet was able to chase the factory vessel out of the Ross Sea at At 100 hours Australian Eastern Daylight Time, the Nishin Maru was lost from the Barbarker's radar. The other two ships in the Sea Shepherd fleet, the Steve Irwin and the Sam Simon, are not being pursued and are shadowing the Nishin Maru. Hammerstedt said this is the second time in February that the Conservation Group ships have been attacked by the Japanese whaling fleet. On February 2nd, the Bob Barker was struck by the Yushin Maru No. 3 in a 9-hour attack on the Sea Shepherd ships, during which the harpoon ships crossed the bows of the Sea Shepherd vessels a total of 86 times, said Hammerstedt. Sea Shepherd Australia has taken over Southern Ocean Whale Defense Campaign since the Institute on Conservation Research obtained an injunction in the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in December of 2012, prohibiting the U.S. Sea Shepherd branch from approaching closer than 500 yards to Japanese vessels. Both sides claim their activities are perfectly legal. In December of 2013, Australian government committed to sending an aircraft to monitor this year's whaling operations. And Camp Perry wind turbine project halted on Lake Erie in this story by abcbirds.org. One of several wind turbine projects planned for the shores of Lake Erie, one of the greatest bird migration corridors in the Western Hemisphere, has been halted following the submission of a letter of intent to sue from the American Bird Conservancy and the Black Swamp Bird Observatory. The two groups had vigorously opposed the project due to its exceptionally high risk to federally protected wildlife. The announcement formalizing the decision to halt the project was made via a letter from Air National Guard Headquarters, the National Guard Bureau Department of Defense in Andrews, Maryland, to the public interest law firm Meyer, Glitzstein & Crystal of Washington, D.C., which represents ABC and BSBO. The campaign charged the efforts in connection with the wind project at Camp Perry Air National Guard Station west of Port Clinton, Ohio, violate the Endangered Species Act and other federal conservation and environmental laws. The letter from the National Guard Bureau states, quote, after carefully considering your objections, I have decided to withdraw the finding of no significant impact for the project effective immediately. Since the FONSI has been withdrawn, the project will not go forward at this time. The letter was dated January 28th and signed by Colonel Peter A. Sartori, Director, Installations and Mission Support. Unquote. The victory sends a strong message to other wind energy developers in this ecologically sensitive region that conservationists will be closely watching their actions. This is a heartening outcome for the environment and for birds, said Dr. Michael Hutchins, National Coordinator of ABC's BirdSmart Wind Energy Campaign. While we support wind energy as a sustainable energy source, we insist that turbines be sited where their impacts to birds and other wildlife will be minimized. This project was among the worst we have seen in that regard. We applaud the government's decision to reconsider the project. We are absolutely elated that the Air National Guard has halted this project, at least temporarily and possibly for good, said Kimberly Kaufman, Executive Director of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory. We certainly owe thanks to the thousands who voiced their opposition to the project via petition. Kaufman points out that the petition will remain open to allow those who still want to sign on to do so. We want to document the full extent of the opposition to this and similar projects in this area in the event the project is reconsidered in the future, she said. This is a big win for the vast numbers of birds that migrate through the Camp Perry area, which have been using these routes and stopover habitats for centuries, said Ken Kaufman, international acclaimed author of bird field guides and a local resident. It's also a win for the local economy and for the businesses that rely on tourism dollars from the tens of thousands of visiting birders. Let's hope that the suspension is a permanent one. American Bird Conservancy and the Black Swamp Bird Observatory assert that the placement of the project at the Camp Perry facility and those proposed for the surrounding areas present an extremely high risk to migrating songbirds, especially the federally endangered Kirtland's warbler. This imperiled species was nearly extinct less than 40 years ago, and while rebounding due to costly and intensive management efforts, still numbers only in the low thousands. Additional birds at risk include other migrating songbirds, raptors, bald eagles, endangered piping plovers, and waterfowl. ABC has created a wind development bird risk map that shows the Lake Erie shoreline in Ohio is among the worst possible locations for a wind power project. The configuration of water and land serves to funnel large numbers of protected migratory birds through a small area. The birds aim to avoid a long lake crossing by hugging the shoreline or following the shortest crosswater route to the Pele Peninsula to the north. This is also a major stopover habitat where migrating birds are not merely flying over but landing and taking off, often during poor weather conditions. According to Ken Kaufman, this funneling effect and stopover behavior would likely put migrating birds precisely in the vicinity of Cape Parry turbines and other wind energy sites proposed for the area. And why the California state's water woes could just be beginning. This is a story by Steve Hawkinsmith of the UC Berkeley News Center. As 2013 came to a close, the media dutifully reported that the year had been the driest in California since records began to be kept in the 1840s. UC Berkeley paleoclimatologist B. Lynn Ingram didn't think the news stories captured the seriousness of the situation. This could potentially be the driest year in 500 years, said Ingram, a professor of Earth and Planetary Science and Geography. Ingram has an especially long-term perspective. As a paleoclimatologist, a scientist who studies changes in climate by teasing data out of rock, sediment, shells, microfossils, trees, and other sources, she's accustomed to looking back over the eons. And according to the width of old tree rings, which can record the coming and going of wet and waterless stretches, California hasn't been so parched since 1580. These extremely dry years are very rare, she says, but soon perhaps they won't be as rare as they used to be. The state is facing its third drought year in a row, and Ingram wouldn't be surprised if that dry stretch continues. Given that possibility, the title of a recent book by Ingram seems grimly apropos. The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climactic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow, co-written with geographer and environmental biologist and UC Berkeley visiting scholar Francis Malamud Rome, was released by the University of California Press last year. The news center spoke to Ingram about the lessons to be drawn from her research as California heads into what could be its worst drought in half a millennium. Question: California is in its third dry year in a row. How long could that continue? The answer: if you go back thousands of years, you see that droughts can go on for years, if not decades, and there were some dry periods that lasted over a century, like during the medieval period and the Middle Holocene. The 20th century was unusually mild here, in the sense that the droughts weren't as severe as in the past. It was a wetter century, and a lot of our development has been based on that. The late 1930s to the early 1950s were when a lot of our dams and aqueducts were built, and those were wetter decades. I think there's an assumption that we'll go back to that, and that's not necessarily the case. We might be heading into a drier period now. It's hard for us to predict, but that's a possibility, especially with global climate change. When the climate's warmer, it tends to be drier. In the West, the storms tend to hit further into the Pacific Northwest like they are this year, and we don't experience as many storms during the winter season. We only get about 7 a year, and it can take the deficit of just a few to create a drought. Question: you mentioned global warming. Is what we're seeing consistent with the predictions that have been made about how climate change could affect California? Answer: yes. We've already started having a decreased snowpack and increased wildfire frequency, and we've been warming, and it's gotten drier. With the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, the ever-changing temperature of surface water in the North Pacific Ocean every 20 or 30 years, we go in and out of these positive and negative shifts that affect precipitation and temperature, but now we're entering a period where it looks like we're getting drier, even though it doesn't necessarily correspond to that cycle. It looks like a trend. It's warming and drying, and that's definitely a big concern for Western states. Question: what originally sparked your interest in all this? Answer: I grew up in Santa Barbara and personally experienced big floods followed by droughts. In 1969, half of our backyard was washed away from an atmospheric river during a wet year. Then the 76-77 drought made a big impression on me because there was almost literally no rain that year. So I was drawn to trying to understand what controls climate and why it's so variable. It's definitely very complex. We haven't explained it completely, but we're on our way. Question: what's an atmospheric river? Answer: that's when corridors of moisture come up from the tropics, traveling across the Pacific Ocean for thousands of miles to the West Coast, and bringing the equivalent of, say, 10 Mississippi rivers of water. There's a lot of rain within 2 or 3 days. Almost all our major floods in California correspond to these atmospheric river storms. The last one that was really major was the 1861-1862 flood. It completely filled the Central Valley with something like 10 feet of water. Sacramento was underwater. I don't know why, but we see evidence for these major mega floods every 1 or 2 centuries over the past 2,000 years. It's been about 150 years now since the last one, and now there are all these major cities in the very places that were submerged. The U.S. Geological Survey created a scenario for this, the Arc Storm, it was called, and showed that if we repeated the 1861 flood, there would be something like $725 billion in damage to the state. It would be a major disaster. Question. So on the one hand, we should be worried about a drought, but on the other hand, we should be worried about floods? Yes, if you look to the past, you realize that our climate is anything but reliable. We've seen these big fluctuations, extreme droughts and extreme floods. My co-author and I wrote a couple of review papers about that, but those weren't going to be seen by the general public. They were for people in our field. And we thought we should try to bring this message out to the broader public. Because if you're going to buy a house in the Central Valley, I think you should know about these floods, and we have to start assuming that we could go into one of these longer droughts and maybe start doing some serious conservation and rethinking of agriculture here. If you look at the archaeological record, you see that the Native American population in the West expanded in the wet years that preceded those long droughts in the medieval period. Then during the droughts, they were pretty much wiped out. There was the so-called Anasazi collapse in the Southwest about 800 years ago. I see that as an analogy to us today. We've had this water 150 years and we've expanded. Now we're using up all the available water, yet our population is still growing. We're vulnerable just like they were, but on an even larger scale. The Enbridge Dilbit spill still not cleaned up as 2013 closes, irritating the Environmental Protection Agency. In this story by David Hassemeyer, Inside Climate News. Little evidence remains of the chaotic scramble to stop the massive oil spill that fouled Michigan's Kalamazoo River in the summer of 2010, yet the full effects of the calamitous accident will likely remain unknown for years. State environmental officials says it could be 2018 before they are ready to issue a final verdict on the damage done to the Kalamazoo after more than 1 million gallons of heavy crude oil poured into the river from a pipeline owned by Enbridge Incorporated. That's the same company that's doing the XL pipeline. At the same time, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is showing increasing irritation with Enbridge over its delay in meeting deadlines in the ongoing cleanup. Federal officials want Enbridge to finish a massive dredging project and institute safeguards to prevent any oil remaining in the river bottom from washing downstream during spring flooding. Both the short-term objective set by the EPA and the review of massive amounts of data collected by the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality are the primary factors that will gauge the Kalamazoo's health. There are lots of things that have to be taken into account when trying to answer the question about the river's future, said Michelle DeLong, the Enbridge Response Unit Chief for MDEQ's Water Resources Division. Enbridge spokesman Larry Springer said the company will continue trying to minimize the effects of the spill, which contaminated nearly 40 miles of the Kalamazoo River. We are, as we always have been, focused on cooperation with the U.S. EPA and other authorities in doing what is best for the river and the environment based on analysis and sound science, Springer said in a written response to questions. Enbridge remains committed to completing the remediation of the Kalamazoo River. We will have a long-term presence in the area and will continue to work in the best interest of the affected communities and river environment. It was near Marshall, Michigan in July of 2010 that Enbridge's aging 6B pipeline burst and spilled heavy Canadian crude known as Dilbit into the river. It was the largest inland oil pipeline spill in U.S. history. So far, the cleanup has cost Enbridge an estimated $1 billion. An Inside Climate News investigation of the accident, the Dilbit disaster, inside the biggest spill you've never heard of, won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. The Kalamazoo's cleanup has been especially difficult because the Dilbit contained a mixture of oil-thinning chemicals and heavy bitumen, which gradually sink as the chemicals evaporated. The EPA estimated earlier this year that about 180,000 gallons of oil remain in the river and ordered Enbridge to do more dredging in three areas. About half of that job is finished, with work continuing at the largest dredging site near Morrow Lake. Although Enbridge has been on notice since March that federal officials wanted the dredging completed by the end of 2013, the company acknowledges that it failed to meet that deadline. In November, Enbridge requested a 10-month extension, saying it had experienced unforeseen delays in finding a suitable base site for the dredging near Morrow Lake. The EPA bristled at the excuse, saying that, quote, Enbridge has taken appropriate steps earlier. As requested, it would not require an extension now, according to Jeffrey Kimball, the EPA's on-scene coordinator. The agency ordered Enbridge to, quote, prepare a comprehensive plan detailing methods and timing of the remaining work, even if that work extends into a time frame of delinquency, unquote. The EPA also told Enbridge it must have containment devices in place before spring flood season to stop oil from moving into uncontaminated sections of the river. Enbridge has argued that there is no evidence that this has happened or will happen, again prompting a scolding from the EPA. Kimball said the EPA completely disagrees with Enbridge's assertion. Springer from the Enbridge said the company removed the vast majority of the oil spilled in 2010 and 2011. He cited a 2012 EPA statement that lauded the company for improved conditions on the river because its cleanup efforts have appeared to be very successful. He also cited a 2011 Michigan Department of Community Health study that found no long-lasting health effects or cancer risk to humans, as well as the 2012 lifting of a ban on eating fish from the river as evidence of Enbridge's effective remediation work. And we turn to some biological diversity news. The international body urges investigation of Canada's refusal to protect polar bears. A key NAFTA body announced that in response to a 2012 petition from the Center for Biological Diversity, it's recommending a formal investigation into Canada's denial of concrete protections to its polar bears. A relatively large number of polar bears living in Canada are at high risk from melting sea ice and other fast-moving ravages of climate change, yet the country only lists the polar bear as, quote, a species of special concern, under its endangered species law, which gives it no real protection. This week's decision identifies several main questions to scrutinize, including whether Canada used the best available climate science when it declined protections in 2011. High-level environmental authorities from Canada, the United States, and Mexico will consider the issue and have 60 days to make a final decision to initiate a full investigation into Canada's polar bear listing. Arctic warming and disappearing sea ice threaten to push polar bears off the planet, said Sarah Ullman, our international program director. Canada needs to acknowledge the scientific facts and take action to protect these amazing animals from extinction. And you can get more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, tune in tomorrow afternoon right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM at 3 p.m. Or if you live in Moscow, Idaho, tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Monday nights at 9:30. You can find them on their new high-power frequency of 90.3 FM. If you'd like to download or listen to a podcast of the Earth First Update, go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening, and tune in next week to another edition of the Earth First Update.